Hello and welcome to another episode of Oncology for the Inquisitive Mind, another special interview episode. I'm Michael and am joined as always by my co-host and co-conspirator in this endeavor, Josh. How are you today, Josh?
Michael, I am excited for another interview episode. We seem to be on a roll this year, but I love speaking to the specialists who are in the room where it happened and essentially know all of the juicy gossip when it comes to the oncology world.
Gotcha. We're really starting strong with a subtle slip of Hamilton lyrics. Our special guest today is a very special guest indeed, and that is Dr. Adam Brovsky. Dr. Brovsky is a professor of medicine at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine, associate chief of the university's Division of Hematology and Oncology, and co-director of its Comprehensive Breast Cancer Center. He wears a lot of hats. He received his MD and PhD from the University of Connecticut School of Medicine in 1990 and has previously worked at Brigham and Women's Hospital and the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Dr. Brovsky's research interests include novel clinical therapeutics for breast cancer, bone-breast cancer interactions and therapeutics, molecular biology of metastatic breast cancer, and novel management strategies for metastatic breast cancer. So Dr. Brovsky, thank you so much for taking time out of your very, very busy schedule to join us here on Oncology for the Inquisitive Mind. And I guess our first question we always like to ask is we're a people-focused podcast, and we like to hear about the people that join us on this program. So could you tell us a bit about your what we call your origin story? Okay. What your superhero origin story? What drew you to medicine first, and then oncology, and I guess breast cancer in particular?
So I mean, I can go on forever. So you can edit this as you want. But I think I've always wanted to be a doc. I mean, there's these books, Time Life books called The Physician. You know, I don't know if you guys are too young for this, but they used to be before the internet or anything else. And they had these books, Time Life put out these books. It was a physician. I read it when I was like 8 years old, and I said, man, this is what I really want to do. And so it's kind of what I wanted to do. And I think that, I went to prep school in the United States, and then I went to Dartmouth College. Well, I went to prep school, and then I was trying to decide kind of how to do it. And, I knew kind of a little bit in college that I wanted to be more kind of a physician scientist. And so what I thought about was going to college graduating early, like graduating 3 years, and then working in someone's lab for 2 years and going to medical school. And then I found these things called MD-PhD programs, which had just come out. This is like kind of like the early 80s. Actually, as I was thinking about all this, it's like a long time, it was 40 years ago. And I said, okay, wow, this is great. I'll get an MD, a PhD, and they'll pay for it. This is like wild. I said, this is great. So I said, okay. So I applied to a couple, and they're obviously, even back then, they're harder now to get into, but they're very hard to get into then. And I got into one at the University of Connecticut. And so, I came there with the idea, actually, of being a neurosurgeon. I read all the books on Harvey Cushing. I read Brodahl's Neuroanatomy as a second-year medical student. And, I was fine. And what I always tell people, and I think it works a little bit different in Australia and the UK, but in the United States, medical school, you have to go to college first. Then you do your first 2 years of research, of like, coursework. Then you go to do your clinical rotations. In your third year, I always tell people, that's kind of where you decide what you want to do. If you want to be a surgeon, you'd be more surgical. If you want to be medical, you do medicine. You like your medicine rotations. You want to do both kind of, you do OB. You want to do neither, you do psychiatry. I mean, that's kind of how people do it. And I realized I love being a neurosurgeon, but I hated my surgical rotation. I just couldn't stand it. That was it. So I decided I wanted to do internal medicine. So what happens is that, in the United States, there are certain programs that take MD-PhDs. And what they do is they do what's called a research residency. So what that means is you'll do your first 2 years as an internal medicine intern and a resident. I think what the corresponding thing is in the UK and Australia. But then you do that. Then you do your first year of clinical fellowship. And that counts as your third year of your, it's 3 years internal medicine residency. And that counts as your third year. And then you then work as a postdoc for a couple of years and become a faculty member and go on. The whole thing takes about 6 years, more over and above medical school. So, you know, the way I came to oncology is kind of interesting. I mean, I loved the clinical part of renal, absolutely loved it, you know, dealing with ions, dialysis, but I'm not really a proton pump kind of guy. You know, I don't like ion channels. You know, I don't want to do research on ion channels. So then I loved the science of endocrinology. I mean, I actually had done some stuff very early on as a medical student, you know, in endocrinology. And I worked with my research advisor was an endocrinologist. And I basically, but, you know, it's all diabetes. Most of it, I mean, it's really cool, like rare stuff, but the vast majority of endocrinologists' life is diabetes and hypothyroidism. And so, you know, that's what I always tell people. The other thing I always tell people is, like the bread and butter of whatever you do. It's great to get turned on by the really rare stuff that really makes you go, wow, I really want to go into this because I saw this really weird growth hormone resistant thing. But that's not what it is. So oncology at the time was really, it still is, really cool because it's really intense internal medicine. You got to know your stuff in multiple specialties. I mean, you know, someone has a headache in our business, you know, it's could be a brain metastasis. And it had really cool science. It was just, I was really into genetics. I had done a lot of DNA sequencing. That was a big deal back then to clone things and sequence them. Now it's like a piece of cake. You do it every day. But back then it was a big deal. And so I was really into it. And I knew that the genetics and oncology were going to explode. I mean, it did actually. And so, you know, I really kind of knew that's what was going to happen. And so I liked it both. So I ended up went to Brigham and Women's Hospital for my internal medicine residency. And then after 2 years, which was really weird doing everything, like I had no break and no electives for my internal medicine, I was a first year fellow at Dana-Farber and then clinical. And then I started going into lab and I thought I was going to be like a lab person, you know, the typical, you know, you, I guess it's, I'm trying to think of the place it's in Melbourne, the Peter McCallum. Yeah. You know, Harvard is kind of like the Peter McCallum, you know, of the United States. And so, you know, I was going to go and I was going to become a lab person, have a lab, write R01, so all that stuff, you know, and I met the woman who's going to become my wife. And I always tell the story. She hates when I tell the story. You know, she goes, you know, Adam, I don't mind if you go in the middle of the night to like for the ICU for a patient, but to feed your cells, you know, I don't want to, you know, because you do, you have to get up in the middle of the night and go feed your cells or run a gel, you know, and take it off. And so that was the end of that. And so I decided to kind of focus, actually, interestingly enough, on clinical investigation in prostate cancer and GU oncology. And I was recruited to the University of Pittsburgh to be a junior GU oncologist, which I did for the first year or two of my career. And then this is about 1996, 97. And so, you know, that's what happened. And so, you know, I was there. I had like a training, they have what's called K08, which is a grant that you get for to kind of, you know, do your research for those couple of years from the NIH. And I started seeing patients at clinic in prostate cancer. And I was there for about a year and a half to 2 years. And then everybody that did breast cancer Pittsburgh left. Everybody. Or someone died. But there was no one there. And, you know, you're the junior person. So what happens? Basically, one of the junior faculty, my division chief comes to me and he goes, Adam, listen, you know, there's a big obstetrics hospital about half a mile away, you know, called McGee Women's Hospital. And they have two breast surgeons there, two breast surgeons, but they don't have a medical oncologist. We want to go down there and just kind of like see what's going on, maybe start a clinic a day a week, you know, and while we try to recruit people to do breast cancer. So, of course, being a junior person, you got to obey your division chief. So I did. And it turns out that I really liked it. And out of like, they gave us like this little tiny three former surgical exam rooms, you know, in the oldest part of the hospital. I think it had been renovated since the 50s. And from that, we turned it into this giant breast cancer program. I mean, I really, you know, and I enjoyed doing it. I mean, we see now probably close to 1,000 new patients a year. We have 12,000 visits and, you know, do all sorts of clinical trials. And so that's kind of my origin story. It's kind of long-winded. I've gone on for about 5 or 10 minutes. But, you know, the bottom line and the lesson to learn is, especially if you're in academics, you know, you never know where you're going to end up. Keep an open mind to new experiences and new changes. Because if you had told me, you know, when I was a medical student that I ended up as a breast cancer medical oncologist, you know, I would have said, you're nuts. I would never have done that. And, you know, I think that I did, though in academics, the other thing that I did definitely know that it was going to be in academics, you have to focus on one thing. It's very hard to be a generalist in academics, especially nowadays. you know, usually it'll focus on a particular tumor or on palliative care or something like that. You know, so that's kind of the other big lesson, at least from my origin story here.
That's a great origin story. And thank you for giving us almost a 35-year snapshot of how you ended up where you are today. We might dive into your expertise, yeah, which is, of course, breast cancer and the reason everyone here is listening. And breast cancer, Adam, I think you might agree, from the 80s when you started med school to now is a very, very different ball game. There's it's completely exploded even in the last couple of years since Michael and I have been doing this. You know, the number of new drugs that have come down under is just astronomical. Yeah. But the question that I wanted to talk
about, I had a front row seat to the whole thing.
Yeah, amazing.
Incredible. Yeah, but go ahead.
I mean, I'm sort of jealous about that because in some way you kind of seen all the old school stuff, which is still very useful. Whereas we're all into like the targeted agents these days, and we haven't seen, I guess, the old days as such. So our kind of clinical expertise might be slightly different. But I wanted to talk to you about the risk stratification and your approach to hormone receptor positive breast cancers. I'm thinking in the early sort of phase breast cancer. How? Because this is, I guess, one of the topical conversations now. You know, you got the Natalie Chow, you've got the Monarch E trial as well, sort of looking at adjuvant therapy. And I'd love to sort of see how your approach to it, because I'll stop talking. I'm the talker of Michael and I, but every sort of institution does a slightly different, but we'd love to sort of hear your thoughts on it.
Sure. Well, just to let you know, I mean, just to answer your first question, because I think it's a really interesting one. I mean, when I first started, and this is now in the mid 90s, actually 97, I think is when I started the breast program at the University of Pittsburgh. At least it was a huge program surgically. I mean, that's where the NSABP came from, all the randomized clinical trials. They had a tremendous surgical kind of, I mean, Bernie Fisher, Norm Walmark, et cetera, you know, just amazing. And that's the birthplace of it. But from a medical oncology standpoint, again, when we started out, I mean, we had very little. I mean, we had Cytoxan, methotrexate, 5-fluorouryl. So we had Adriamycin and Cytoxan. That was it. We had tamoxifen. We didn't even have aromatase inhibitors back then. We had tamoxifen, aminoglutethamide, and testosterone, basically, and high-dose estrogen. That was it. And you had to take care of people with that. And it was just really wild. And so, you know, and again, as somebody who has a molecular biology background, you know, we kind of knew pretty early on, you know, that I think using molecular testing for risk stratification was going to be very important. And it's really interesting. I was there kind of when, you know, Oncotype DX was developed. I helped them, you know, in the early days. And literally it came from the HIV business. You know, they had just figured out how to do RT-PCR to detect HIV levels. You know, this is how old this is. And Genomic Health was founded by a bunch of guys from Roche, at Genentech at the time. And they figured out how to do RT-PCR on paraffin-embedded tissue. And I was trying to do it myself as a junior. Like, that was my first big project. I got a grant from the U.S. Komen Foundation to try to develop a molecular test to risk stratify breast cancer. And so, because I'm a junior person, I didn't have that much resources. And, you know, unlike some of these other places, what I decided to try doing was develop a risk stratification. I figured, okay, node-positive breast cancer is worse. So why don't I develop a kind of a molecular test that'll tell you whether you're node-positive or not? Well, it turns out, and we'll get to this in a little bit later, that node positivity, you can't predict node positivity. It's a separate issue. The tumor does potentially have a little bit to do with lymph node positivity, but not as much as we thought it did. And so my molecular test didn't work. And it turns out the guys from, you know, Agendia, you know, in the Netherlands, Laura Esserman and Renee Bernards, figured it out, published a great paper in Nature in 2002, I think. That would have been mine. I always joke that if I'd done it the right way, it would have been me founding Agendia, not them. But, you know, we had that. And then Oncotype came on the thing, and they figured out how to do RT-PCR in paraffin-embedded tissue. And they got it really well. They could block from anywhere. And so, you know, we suddenly, out of nowhere, I mean, let me kind of go back a little bit. The way we used to risk stratify is basically by clinical judgment. That was it. Someone would come in, and we say, okay, we know you have a big tumor. And we know you have lots of lymph nodes. You kind of need chemo. We didn't have a lot of data. In fact, back then, you know, we weren't even giving women, premenopausal women, tamoxifen. Weren't even chemotherapy. I mean, really, it was like 1992, 93. They had these position statements come out. So anyway, be that as it may, I think that what happened with Oncotype, and this is just really interesting for all of these kind of genomic testing and risk stratifying tests, is that initially, you know, everybody could do prognosis. And that's kind of where we are now with minimal residual disease testing in most tumors, just to kind of bring everything together. And no one cared. I mean, the docs cared. We thought it was great. We said, oh, you know, and so we went to our insurance payers, because the United States is a little bit different. There's no national health system. And so we went to our local insurance payers around Western Pennsylvania, and we said, you know, we got this test that can tell us if a woman's going to relapse or breast cancer or not. You know, and they said, okay, what are you going to do with the data? You know, we said, does it predict for chemo benefit? And we said, we don't know. And they said, well, we're not paying for it. And so Oncotype did not take off until there was another trial called NSABBB20, which was basically tamoxifen with or without chemotherapy. Without chemotherapy. And the NSABP was able to get the tissue blocks from that and do Oncotype on them and found out that Oncotype predicted a chemo benefit in about probably a third of the patients or so. And suddenly after that, the docs had a test that they could use for a clinical decision. And it just took off. So then you have Oncotype, then you have MammaPrint. MammaPrint was kind of slower in the United States because it used to have to be done on fresh frozen tissue, and no one had, you know. Sure, you do. We used to do, you know, before the days of sentinel node, we would do a frozen tissue, frozen specimen. So the surgeon would take out one node or a couple nodes. They would do a frozen specimen, and then the idea behind MammaPrint was to do it on that frozen specimen that they took out, you know, to get kind of the preliminary data on the lymph nodes for the surgeon to decide whether to do a lymph node dissection. So this is in the pre-sentinel node days. And so, but then, so they were a little delayed. They figured out how to do it on paraffin-embedded tissue probably in the late 2000s. And so then we had that test. We also have EndoPredict. So the bottom line is that I think for risk stratification for early-stage breast cancer, I think most of us, you know, in the United States, where available, try to use when we can one of these multiparametric genomic tests. And so we try to do that. But on the other hand, that gets very expensive. And there are areas of the world where you can't do it. You know, the payers won't let you do it. So we developed, actually, very interestingly, a regression equation based on the immunohistochemistry of the tumor, ERPR, HER2, Ki-67. And the tumor size, and we were able to predict the Oncotype score. It's called the McGee equation. It's actually on the internet. You just look it up. And you can plug it all in, and it will basically predict the Oncotype score for you. And I've gone around the world talking about it, and some people have really picked it up. It hasn't really gotten a lot of traction in the U.S., which is kind of interesting. It's got more traction internationally. But the bottom line is that that's kind of how we do that initial risk stratification. And so where we're going with this in early-stage breast cancer, you know, and we'll kind of talk about a lot of this as time, you know, as you guys want to kind of direct the conversation, is that, you know, we still have to go back. It turns out that a lot of this risk stratification is great for the first 5 years. Like a woman comes in, you do an Oncotype, it's 29 or something like that. And so you choose chemo and then hormonal therapy. But it turns out after year five, it kind of breaks down. And so it turns out we need tumor size and the number of lymph nodes, believe it or not, to kind of help us. So some of the newer tests like EndoPredict and some of the other tests involve lymph node positivity as well as tumor size. It turns out that MammaPrint can predict pretty well between years 5 and 10 who's going to relapse. So who needs extended endocrine therapy? There's another test called BCI, Breast Cancer Index, that kind of does it, although the data we just published a few weeks ago with a bunch of other people from the NSABP. It really did not statistically significantly do it, even though it's approved in the United States. So, you know, so what we're doing now with this, with the whole idea behind here, is to get a single test, you know, core biopsy of a woman, and from that core biopsy, unveil exactly what we're going to do with her. That's at least my vision. I think it's a lot of people's vision that, you know, A, you know, what's your prognosis of 10 years? Are you going to relapse or not? Two, do you need chemo or not? Three, if you need endocrine therapy, how long? Okay, and so that's kind of thing. And then four, which we're trying to do now, a lot of us, is do you need immunotherapy or not? We now have molecular tests that can do that, we think. Do you need CDK4/6 inhibitor? People are still trying to develop that. But the whole idea is from a single core, when the patient walks in the door, you can do all that. And people have tried to do it for triple negative breast cancer. And I think the idea in triple negative is going to be, you know, we're talking right now just about ER positive, you know, early stage disease. But the bottom line is that I think we're going to be at a point probably within the next 5 years, I'm guessing, probably five or more. It just depends on how long it's going to take to do the trials. But we're going to be able to do on a core biopsy almost all of that. It's going to be really neat. And it's going to be, risk stratification has gone. So it's gone basically in my career from us using our clinical judgment to actually having a molecular test tell you what you should do as soon as the patient's diagnosed.
Which is fantastic because at least from my perspective, with a lot of these patients, one thing that really gets them from their perspective is that sort of element of uncertainty, you know, what is going to happen is that, you know, I mean, I don't need to tell you this, Adam, but I cannot count the number of times I've been asked, will this cancer come back?
Right.
And you sort of have to say, well, look, the odds are this and then that and then. But sticking with the early hormone receptor positive breast cancer space, because you alluded to a couple of points that we would really like to get your opinion on, and that is first the adjuvant CDK4/6, which is obviously shall we call it a tumultuous space at the moment with three competing agents, parallel evidence, no head-to-head comparisons, and we'd really like to get your sense of how you make sense of all of this very confusing data. But also you mentioned immunotherapy. Now immunotherapy is getting increasing traction in the triple negative space, obviously with the various keynote studies of Pembro, but outside the triple negative space, what's your assessment of where that's going?
So you want to start with early, you want to start with early stage disease, right? Not medicine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So, KEYNOTE-756 is a trial that hasn't been published yet. It was presented at two major meetings within the last 6 months, which basically shows that, in a certain particular patients, those with kind of lower estrogen receptor, it looks like, you have benefit from immunotherapy when you give it neoadjuvantly for ER-positive breast cancer, which we never thought. I mean, you know, the pathologic complete response rate is like 3% or 10% at best. And we've gone now, they're now, if you pick the patients correctly, like you have an ER-positive patient's PD-1 positive, maybe ER-low, you have a PCR rate of about 44%, which is pretty dramatic. And I think that we're waiting for the event-free survival to see if it matches that, you know, because always in these trials now, and it's a reasonable thing. They used to think that PCR was an adequate endpoint, but I think most of the regulatory agencies really want event-free survival now at 3 years or 4 years. So we're waiting for that in KEYNOTE-756. So that's something that probably is going to happen. So that's immunotherapy. Interestingly enough, there are assays. There's one called Imprint that's made by Agendia. There's a few others out there that either use RNA on the tumor or proteomics on the tumor to predict immunotherapy benefit. I think we're going to be probably using those. I think the ER-positive patient who needs to receive immunotherapy or not, I think is going to be one of the big ones where we're going to start using these tests for immunotherapy benefit. Triple negative is another, just to kind of delve into triple negative for 1 minute, and I'll come back. Most women with triple negative breast cancer with a tumor over 2 centimeters, and I think this is worldwide, I think you guys do this in Australia too, basically get what's the KEYNOTE-522 regimen, which is basically Pembro, paclitaxel, carboplatin, followed by anthracycline, cytoxin times 4. And so with Pembro, for the entire, then you get a PCR, we still give you Pembro. So there's a trial called Optimice in the United States where people who have a PCR are randomized to no Pembro or Pembro. And we're going to hopefully see that. And what we're trying to do is tag on some of these immunotherapy multiparametric assays to that trial to see if they're going to be predictive in those patients with a PCR of who needs therapy or not. So, you know, we'll see. So, I mean, I think that's where this is going. So back to triple negative, ER positive. So again, in ER positive, you got a lot of decisions to make, right? So the first one is, do you need chemo or not? Well, that's the first decision. The second decision is, do you need immunotherapy or not? Or that's going to be. But the real one, and the one you kind of alluded to, and we'll just talk about adjuvant, and then we'll get to the metastatic CDK4s, which is totally different. But in the adjuvant setting, we clearly have abemaciclib. And the monarchy trials clearly at 5 years, just presented again at ESMO this year, and again, I think at San Antonio, clearly there is a really for patients with stage 3 disease, definitely, there's a substantial event-free survival benefit, even the hints of an overall survival benefit that they showed when they showed the monarchy data, the last, I think the 5-year update. And so there are patients clearly that benefit from CDK4/6 inhibitors, but the problem is that it's not everybody. And you're going to get the same relative benefit. This is always what we said, is because this is what we used to use back in the olden days when we didn't have anything. You're going to probably get the same relative benefit, but the question is an absolute benefit. And that brings us to ribociclib. And the thing is, we have the NATALEE trial, that in node negative ER positive breast cancer purportedly and does show a benefit to adjuvant CDK4/6 3 years of adjuvant ribociclib. That's an enormous amount of money. B, women, you know, I'm not sure they really want to take 3 years of adjuvant ribociclib. And so the way I've looked at it in my practice is most people with stage 3 breast cancer or an enormous amount of disease left over after neoadjuvant therapy, those are the people probably that will get an adjuvant CDK in my practice. I'm not going to, a woman with, you know, an oncotype of 26, 2-centimeter breast cancer, 60 years old, a node negative, even though the trial says this is a woman who could get ribociclib, personally, now this is a matter, as you can say, of great controversy and debate right now in our business, you know, I'm not going to do it. I think that the absolute benefit to me is no more than a couple percent, maybe 1 or 2%. You know, and I think that's what we're going to have to do. We're going to have to use our clinical judgment with these agents to say, listen, you know, this is the absolute benefit of 3 years of additional, you know, fairly, it could be potentially toxic therapy. Do you really want to do that? And a lot of women, you know, I've talked to them about this, even with stage 3 breast cancer. You know, I've talked to them about, you know, going on abemaciclib for 2 years, and they say no. And I think that's okay. All you have to do is present it. It's another tool that we have, especially for people at high risk of recurrence. Specifically, someone comes in with 4 or 5 lymph nodes, you know, maybe a grade 3 tumor, they're going to get adjuvant abema in my practice. And it's really interesting. The other big thing that people have been saying is, well, you know, these patients who come in with this really aggressive stage 3 disease, ear positive stage 3 disease, maybe they really have occult metastatic disease and we're really treating them earlier for occult metastatic disease. And what we have potentially to answer that question is FES PET. So they now have FES PET now where we can, you know, use PET tracer for the estrogen receptor. And especially in lobular breast cancer, it is extremely sensitive in picking up metastatic disease, probably more sensitive than usual CTs or PETs. And I think a lot of those people that were in the monarchy trial, I think not a lot, but probably a proportion of the stage 3 patients in the monarchy trial, even though they didn't have any evidence of metastatic disease when they were enrolled, if we had done an FES PET on them, I suspect a decent percentage of them, maybe 10, 15, 20%, may have had occult metastatic disease that we didn't see. And I think that, so this is kind of where the field is going. We need to be more precise. We can't give CDKs to everybody in the adjuvant setting. We just cannot do it. We don't have the resources for it, and I don't think the patients really need to go through it. We're going to have to be very judicious going forward, I think, is in the adjuvant CDKs.
It almost seems a bit of a double-edged sword, the breast cancer world. I did my fellowship in breast cancer as well, that, you know, you have more and more options for these patients. But the question is, when you're reaching to 5 or 10 years of actual giving them therapy for a curative cancer that might not come back anyhow with such great outcomes, it really does become quite an ethical question. Which brings me to my next, and we might jump a little bit. And there was a trial a couple of years back that looked, and we're going to talk about the HER2 space just briefly, if that's okay.
Sure. Oh, no problem. I can talk about any space you want. I can talk for hours.
I can tell. This is great. So the adjuvant HER2, so HER2 is one of those incredible breast cancer stories for the last 15 years. It's become like the worst, one of the worst prognoses to one of the best. Now, usually we give 12 months of adjuvant Herceptin. And there was a recent trial looking at 6 months versus 12 months in the adjuvant setting showing it was non-inferior. Now, in Australia, the practice hasn't really changed to kind of condense it from a 12-month to a 6-month period. Now, I was interested in your take on this data and whether you see, like adjuvant pembrolizumab, right? You know, we don't know the year of adjuvant, whether it's going to help in the triple negative space with complete pathological response. In this particular setting, is it worth it? Like, what's your rationale for giving the 6 months versus 12 months? And how would you approach this?
So, again, it's a great question. And I think it's the Persephone trial that you're talking about. We really haven't seen any more updated data on that. I think it was presented, as you said, I think it was published a couple of years ago, probably pre-pandemic, I think probably 2019 or something, or 2018. And we haven't seen any update on that. I'd love to see the long-term update on it. But on the other hand, I think there were subgroups that definitely did not meet the non-inferior criterion. That was the problem. And so people who wanted to give didn't really felt uncomfortable. Docs, as you know, are very conservative and they don't want to kind of de-escalate. unnecessarily. And so, you know, I think we all love to de-escalate, but we want to have data to help us. I personally don't have a problem of giving 6 versus 12. I don't do it as usual practice. I still give 12. But I have to, because of that subgroup analysis they had done and showing there's certain subgroups that maybe benefited more from the 12 months. But I don't have a problem. I think that, you know, women, if they have trouble taking it, then I'm comfortable stopping after 6 months. I don't have a problem with that. I think the really interesting question, which you didn't ask, is we'll probably get to metastatic disease, is how long to give Herceptin in metastatic disease, especially a woman who has a complete pathological, complete clinical response. You know, what are you going to do? I have women who took Herceptin from the original trial, 23 years, and they had a port, and the port never came out. It's part of their body. You can't take the port out now. They never wanted to change it. And so, but that's a different question entirely. We'll get to that in a few minutes, I think, if you want to talk about metastatic disease. But in early stage in HER2, you know, there it turns out we have a molecular way of figuring that out as well, believe it or not. There's this company that's a company in Spain that comes out of Spain. Alish Pratt is a young, not young now, he's kind of mid-career, really smart guy. I think he's in Barcelona. He came up with this test called HER2-DX, which can actually prognosticate for HER2. A lot of us don't use it yet, but I think that it's on the tumor itself, and it gives you a prognostic score, like your risk of recurrence in X number of years. It gives you whether you're going to have a PCR from chemo or not, and trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and that's kind of cool. And I think those are the sort of, again, molecular tests may help us figure out this 12 versus 6 question. The other way to do it, you know, we're trying to figure out what to do with minimal residual disease, right? You know, these MRD tests, everybody wants to do an MRD test. You know, everybody has a trial, but they're all prognostication. We don't do anything with the data because we don't know what to do with it. I think a really cool thing, both with immunotherapy as well as with trastuzumab, is that if after your therapy, you've had a PCR, and even maybe not, well, probably if you had a PCR. If you had a PCR, because you don't have a PCR, you're going to get an ADC or you're going to T-DM1 or T-DXd eventually. If you have a PCR after neoadjuvant chemotherapy and anti-HER2 therapy, and if you do a minimal residual disease test and MRD and it's negative, maybe randomization to 12 versus 6 months of stopping the trastuzumab or giving the other, you know, the HP for another, you know, 6 months. That would be a really cool use of MRD. It's the same thing with triple negative and Pembro. You know, a really cool trial, and I'm sure people have thought of this, is, okay, you've had a PCR from your KEYNOTE-522 regimen in triple negative breast cancer. Let's do an MRD on you, and if it's negative, randomize you to continued Pembro or stopping. And I think those are the sort of things where I think molecular testing is going to help us figure that out. But right now, back to your question, I mean, I've been very long-winded, as you could tell, on that small question. You know, I would say that I don't have a problem if someone really, you know, for cost reasons, whatever reason, you know, I have a very low threshold, especially since it's a PCR, to stop their HP. I have a fairly low threshold to do that. And the Persephone trial has given me comfort to do that. But it's not my default. I'll put it that way.
Long-winded, Adam, you belong on this podcast because we're both very long-winded as well. I think one last question in the early phase before we get on to our metastatic questions. And that is, we've talked about PCRs following neoadjuvant therapy. We've talked about de-escalation of adjuvant therapy for people who respond really well. There was a phase 2 study, I think it was presented at either ESMO or San Antonio, I think ESMO, about the omission of surgery itself.
Yes.
For people who had a PCR and a vacuum-assisted biopsy. We're seeing this places where I've worked there in rectal cancer, they're actually looking to omit surgery for patients who have PCR based on MRI and sigmoidoscopy biopsy and what have you. Do you think that that is something that breast cancer is headed towards?
Yes.
Or is it, you do, because the flip side of that is this is obviously a very curable disease and you mentioned the physicians are very conservative. So at what point do we feel comfortable enough to eliminate what is the bedrock of early breast cancer treatment in surgery?
I mean, I think we've realized from the studies of Bernie Fisher and Bernie Fisher, when he first came out, I mean, the whole concept that breast cancer was a systemic and not a local disease of diagnosis is a true scientific breakthrough. I mean, and it was a paradigm shift and it took a long time we're still in that paradigm shift. I mean, I think that, you know, breast cancer is a systemic disease, and it has two components: the breast cancer growing itself and its characteristics, and your body's response to it. And I think that we're just learning. See, that's going to be, your guys are going to see, I'm jealous of you. You're jealous of, I'm jealous of you guys, because you're going to be there when we figure out the host response and how to manipulate it, which we don't really know how to do right now. And we kind of do with immunotherapy a little bit, but it's like baby steps. You guys are going to be there for all of this. And that's the bottom line of breast cancer. And I think that we are starting to realize, specifically in HER2 of all of them, in HER2, you know, probably eight, if you're ER negative, HER2 positive, about 80% of people have a PCR, no disease whatsoever. And I think that we're getting to the point where I think there are already trials like that in the United States, similar to what was presented at the meeting, where it's called exceptional responders. So it's about, but these are phase twos, about 100, 200 people. They're not really randomized studies of surgery, no surgery. We're going to need that, I think, to convince people to do it. But I'm totally there. I've had a few patients in my practice, you know, who had very advanced disease, really was stage three. I have one person in particular. I still remember she comes in, you know, every 6 months. She had, you know, probably 15, not 15, maybe she had bulky lymphadenopathy, and probably a 6-centimeter breast mass. She had ER negative, HER2 positive breast cancer. I gave her TCHP, and I continued, and she had a complete clinical response. And we did an MRI of her breast, nothing there. And she said, I don't want surgery. I said, are you sure? You know, this is not the standard. This is like, and now to tell you the story, the punchline, this is 5 years ago. And the question becomes, and we finally decided after 5 years, let's stop your HP. You know, well, just stop it. What is it doing? Because it's like lymphoma. If you really think carefully with HER2 positive disease, it's probably a lot like lymphoma. You know, in lymphoma, you know, you have a lymphoma. It's not common, but you get a lymphoma like of your bone, right? We don't remove the lymphoma from your bone. We treat you systemically. And I think it's the same thing with certain solid tumors. Now, the problem with this is that there are certain tumors that need nothing, you know, at all. I mean, they're slow growing, ER positive, small tumors, you know, grade one, older woman, maybe 70, 80 years old, you know, those probably don't need to be treated at all. They're more like the prostate cancer. When you think about prostate cancer, there are certain men with prostate cancer who do watchful waiting. There are likely women with breast cancer that watchful waiting would be reasonable. There are trials of that in DCIS right now, but these are great questions. And I think that the issue is that, are we going to do the trials to make these happen? The answer is likely unknown. Because governments don't have the capital. I mean, governments used to do all the randomized big trials. They're all sponsored by the various governments. Nowadays, no one has the capital to do a giant trial like that. The only people who do that are industry. And industry doesn't want you to reduce therapy. They want you to increase therapy. So that's the problem. And I think that, but back to surgery, again, surgeons are very conservative. I think it's going to take a really well-defined, randomized phase three trial to convince people to do it. I think a lot of people will start doing it, but we're going to need a big randomized phase three. And you're going to have to convince the women. I think women, most women would want it, that if you basically have a negative MRI and the tumor bed biopsy is negative after your therapy, your neoadjuvant therapy, I think some women would go for it. Some women would not. I mean, some women are afraid that the little microscopic cells are left behind, not unreasonably, that will grow and suddenly spread. And so it's going to be really interesting to see what happens. But just to the, again, I'm long-winded. I can go on this forever. It turns out that, you know, there are people in my practice, and I'm sure other people around the world, who are doing this already, specifically people with more advanced disease. I mean, I think that kind of that borderline of 3 and 4, and you don't really know whether, you know, you're going to be really aggressive locally, you know, if it's going to work or not, but they have a PCR or a clinical CR at least. And you're going, all right, you know, let's just leave you be. I think certain people were doing that already.
Another great answer. We might jump across to the metastatic world of breast cancer, which is, sure, I think, as Michael put in his little pro forma, quite a big area of, to an extent, unmet need. You know, you have the patients like yours and some of mine who have been on Herceptin for eons, and you know, the question is, are they actually cured? But let's talk about the later lines of therapy in both the triple negative breast cancer space and the HER2 positive breast cancer space. Both areas have somewhat exploded, I think is a nice way to put it. But still, you know, still we don't have that golden that, I mean, maybe for Triple Negative more if we focus on that, that golden kind of marker or that golden treatment to kind of keep someone on a drug for 15 years and kind of manage their disease. But I'd love to get your take on it.
So again, we'll get back to this, I'm sure, but CDK4 is in breast, okay, have clearly changed the natural history. I mean, most women now are living, as you know, 5 to 10 years of metastatic triple negative disease. Probably CDKs have had a big reason for that. Her trastuzumab, Herceptin, trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and now even TDXD. I mean, now women are living 5 to 10 years with metastatic, and some of them are, as we said before, probably cured of their disease in the metastatic setting in HER2. But triple negative is the mystery. One, probably the biggest reason we don't really understand it. I mean, I think it's multiple diseases that were just lumped together. Some of them more rare. It's almost like sarcoma is the best kind of analogy. You know, we don't have a cure for sarcoma because sarcoma is probably 15 or 20 different diseases. I think triple negative is like that. Again, I think this is where probably molecular testing and is going to help to some degree stratify people a little bit. But we really don't have that magic bullet. I think what we have, the closest thing we have right now are ADCs. And I think the real mystery, and I think where people are going, at least for now, there are two places where we're going in triple negative. I think most people, if the PD-1L1 positive are going to get immunotherapy in the first line, probably in the second line, depending if they're HER2 positive or not, or HER2 low or not, get TDXD or sacituzumab. And I think that, and then the question is, what do you do after that? After that, in a post-ADC for, second line world, what do you do? No one knows. Because again, we don't really understand the cancer that much. And another thing, we don't really understand what ADCs do. We think we know what they do, but we really don't when you really think about it, because we don't really understand the toxicity. And I've asked multiple people going back to the beginning of this, why does one ADC give you interstitial lung disease and another one give you mucositis and another one give you keratitis? Why is that? And people wave their hands and they come up with theories, but there's really no proof of any of it. And the other thing is that, are the ADCs really taken up into the cell in humans? And if they are, how slow is it? How fast is it? Does a linker cleave in the extracellular space or not? No one knows. So what I'm saying in a long-winded way is that in triple-negative breast cancer, I think where we're probably going is ADC after ADC after ADC. I suspect that's kind of going to be one of the ways that we're going to kind of prolong survival. I think we already have already in triple-negative breast cancer. It's still not good. It's not where we want it to be. I mean, we want triple-negative at a minimum to be like ER-positive and HER2-positive disease, where it's 5 to 10 year average people that live. And we obviously want it for much longer, and I'll get to that in a minute. But the thing is that we don't have that in triple negative. So the other big area is really understanding the immunology of the disease. I think triple negative is probably the most immune of the three subtypes of breast cancer. And I just don't think we understand enough about the tumor microenvironment and how to manipulate it. I think we're starting to get there. But we just have a lack of the basic knowledge. We have some, don't get me wrong, I'm not poo-pooing it. We have some, but I think that we're going to need a little bit more to understand how to manipulate it better. And again, you guys are the ones. I'm jealous of you because I'm going to be retired by then. You guys are the guys that are going to figure this out, what we're going to need to do to manipulate the microenvironment of triple negative breast cancer, especially in the metastatic setting, where it's probably become, the immune microenvironment has changed dramatically as you go further and further along in your therapies. But that's where it's going. So right now, we have probably the big mystery is ADC after ADC, and what do you do afterwards? And I think that's kind of the standard right now in triple negative. But where it's going is what I told you. A better understanding of ADCs, better understanding maybe a bispecific antibodies, maybe an ADC plus something else that attracts T cells or whatever. Maybe a bispecific ADC, who knows? I think that that's kind of where at least the triple negative business is going.
We've you've spoken sort of about ADCs at length, and they are the hot new thing, as we've said multiple times on this show. They're Josh's absolute favorite class of drugs ever.
They're mine too, by the way. I kind of like them.
They're certainly very interesting, and I guess there's a lot of potential because basically you can combine two things, and you can just sort of mix up any combination that you think works. But as you sort of mentioned, there's not really too many targets. And I think there's a lot, particularly in the triple negative space, there's a lot of work going into, well, if it's not ER, it's not PR, it's not HER2 that's driving these cancers, then what is? Which leads me to my question. I mean, you've, Adam, you're clearly heavily involved in the real bleeding edge, and you've got your ear to the ground and speaking to a bunch of people also there. Are you getting any whispers about what the future might hold in terms of biological targets, that silver bullet, or do you think that triple negative breast cancer is just too heterogeneous for there to be
one? It's a hard question to answer. I think that one thing, they're clearly about 10% of triple negative is probably AR driven, androgen receptor driven, and understanding of how to do that. You know, maybe we need to use an androgen agonist, not an antagonist. And that's one thing. I think that's one, but that's only a small slice. Clearly, a certain percentage of triple negative breast cancer is a homologous recombination repair deficient. And I think getting a better understanding and better PARP inhibitors and daughter of PARP inhibitor, that's the big thing now, actually, is really kind of novel agents, novel PARPs, you know, that are stronger, bind better, bind to different parts of the DNA, you know, inhibit different parts of the DNA repair pathway. That's kind of something that I think is going to probably bear fruit. I know there are large phase three clinical trials that are ongoing. So that's kind of where, at least initially, targets. People have thought about the mTOR-AKT pathway. There is a trial called Capitello 290 that was actually completed 2 or 3 years ago that took women with triple negative breast cancer and gave them paclitaxel with or without capivasertib, which is the hot new, you know, AKT inhibitor. And interestingly enough, that trial has not been closed for futility. Unlike the companion drug, I think it was the Roche drug, I'm blanking on the name, but the Roche drug, the Roche AKT inhibitor, it was abandoned for futility. But it was not abandoned for futility, and we haven't seen the results yet. So something's going on there. And I think that, to me, if you ask me the question about what the hot targets are, that, at least that are clinically actionable within a couple of years, that, to me, is probably the most interesting one. Now, it could be totally dead negative, and they're just not saying it to anybody because the company doesn't want to release the data, which they have to kind of release the data. But I think that, I think that may be very interesting. I'm very looking very forward to that. So you ask me kind of where the targets are right now, the whispers of targets. I think AKT pathway, I think more homologous recombination deficiency repair in the near term. I think there are other things people are trying to find. You know, it's hard. As you said before, it's a very heterogeneous disease. And, you know, we tried Avastin. We tried bevacizumab many, many years ago. And it's still available, actually, in your country and in most countries except the U.S. The U.S. FDA said, no, you can't do it. We don't buy the data. And there probably are. I think, again, it comes down to molecular classification. There probably are triple negative diseases out there that probably have a very nice response to Avastin with some sort of other systemic therapy. We just need a better way of figuring out what those are. And again, I think back to the thing at the end of the day, manipulation of the microenvironment, not particularly the tumor. So host manipulation is going to be really important. It's just a concept. It's a whole paradigm shift in our business, you know, from like manipulating the tumor to manipulating the host. And that is going to, it's equally as just a dramatic paradigm shift as the Bernie Fisher, you know, breast cancer is a systemic disease. And we're really getting stuff to manipulate the host and not not necessarily the tumor, I think is going to be really interesting.
All very, I think, fascinating and insightful points about breast cancer. And it's interesting you talk about the microenvironment. Pancreatic cancer, as a very mild aside, there was a big there's a big trial going on in Australia looking at like the NOD2 mutation, which has found that it manipulates the microenvironment. They can find that chemotherapy is actually far more effective in the pancreatic space, which for all those that listen, it's a terrible cancer. Yeah.
Oh, it's pancreas is awful. But again, in pancreas, we have hints, you know, a certain percentage. In fact, BRCA2 was cloned from a pancreatic cancer, by the way, in 1984. People tend to forget that. You know, homologous repair deficiency in pancreatic cancer probably is going to have a role, by the way. But either, I should point you guys to a paper. It's a really cool paper using artificial intelligence. What they did is they looked, I think these guys, it was in Nature or Nature Communications or something like that, probably about a month or two ago. One of my fellows turned me on to this. What they did is they took photomicrographs of about probably 10,000, 15,000 tumors, and they had all the clinical response data, you know, relapse or not from it. And the AI was able to develop several features that were more predictive of relapse and death than anything we have, than anatomic, you know, molecular testing, whatever. You know, it was really cool. And it turns out the features that were most important were the chromatin condensation of the T cells in the microenvironment and how fibroblastic the microenvironment was. It's really cool paper. People aren't really talking about that yet. I think at least not in the overall breast cancer community. I mean, I'm sure there are pockets of people that understand the paper that have been talking about it. But that to me is really interesting. Back to this whole microenvironment business. That's a hint as to where I think everything is going to go.
You half answered my question already, which is great. But my second final question before Michael wraps up this episode is, what do you think the future holds for breast cancer? I know we've spoken about the microenvironment, we've spoken a bit about AI and kind of these targeted therapies, but where do you think the industry or the specialty as a whole is sort of heading in the 10, 15 year mark?
Yeah, I think patient selection and therapy de-escalation in early stage disease. I think we're at the point now where the vast majority of women with breast cancer are going to be alive in 5 and 10 years, if not longer, and probably just be cured of their disease, like testicular cancer, I think, in many ways. And that's really changed in mine. That's the big, big news from my career, I think, is that seeing that you've gone from maybe a third to, you know, 40, 50% of patients dying of their breast cancer to now maybe 10 or 20%. That's the big success of our business. And so now the question is, just like with testicular cancer, we need to try to figure out how to de-escalate therapy. And we will use the tools of molecular biology and patient selection to figure that out. So that's number one. Number two, I think the cure, and it's not really cure. We never use cure in our business, unfortunately. You know, but I think that in metastatic disease, we're seeing hints now, at least from the HER2 space, as well as increasingly in the ER-positive metastatic space, that women can live a long time. And cure or success, I think, in metastatic disease really is going to look like turning it into a chronic disease. And so that's going to be what we're going to need to do is when we turn breast, and that's where it's going. And then once we turn into a chronic disease, then we'll start de-escalating the therapy then. You know, maybe you won't need as much immunotherapy. Maybe we'll stop your CDK, you know, or we'll stop your trastuzumab or something like that. And I think that's where the field is going. Now, the big issue that's holding this back, now we're getting to this issue now, we really didn't talk about it in this episode, is what I think is going to be the limiting factor is brain metastasis. Is that a lot of our tools, a little bit more than we think, but still not enough, don't penetrate the blood-brain barrier. And so what happens is now women, even with ER-positive disease, are developing brain metastasis and leptomeningeal disease, and that's how they die. I mean, it's not common as much anymore for women to die of liver failure, at least in my practice in breast cancer. It's mostly CNS disease. And I think that's another big path that we have to figure out is how to deal with the CNS, how to better diagnose it, how to better characterize it, because we're not going to sit there and do brain biopsies on people all the time. So we're going to have to figure out, at least through other tools, how to characterize the cancer. So that's going to be another big thread. But that's of all of cancer, too. I think so. That's where the future is really going in breast is basically better patient selection for therapy. So patient therapy de-escalation, early disease, and turning metastatic disease into more of a chronic state that you can live with for the remainder of your life. I mean, you know, 15, 20 years of metastatic breast cancer, you may die of something else. And everybody has to die of something, unfortunately. And I think the goal, in at least in metastatic cancer treatment, is to take someone who would have ordinarily died from that maybe in their 50s or 60s and let them live to 80, you know, something like that. That's kind of what I think, to me, success, at least at this point in time, is going to look like.
That's a fantastic summary, and I guess something that is an approach that's very optimistic and hopeful, Adam, which if you look at sort of the day-to-day, it can be quite easy to get a bit pessimistic, get a little bit fatalist in our business, as you said. But it's always important to know that we are making progress, incremental though it may be. We always like to wrap up these interviews with the same question, and that is coming. We started with the person of Dr. Adam Brovsky, and we like to finish there as well, which is, and you sort of, you're very good at preempting our questions on this interview, but you sort of already answered this already. If you could give any advice to your younger self when you were just starting on this journey, what would it be if you could go back and sort of talk to your younger self?
So the first thing is kind of what I did is keep an open mind to where you're going to go. don't get sucked into one particular pathway, you know, especially when you're first starting out. I think that's really important. Be as broad as you can, you know, within reason. The other thing is really pick your mentors, find a good mentor, a senior mentor. That's one thing. I've had mentors over the years, but I never really had a consistent senior mentor. I think that's one thing I would tell myself is another thing. And the other thing is that, you know, ask yourself pretty early on what you like out of the career, especially if you're in academics. You know, do you want to be someone who does patient care? Do you want to be someone who wants to do research, whether it's bench, dry or wet or whatever? And do you want a leadership position? You know, I think some people, you know, I think that's the one thing for me, because I've always been ambivalent, you know, about leadership, you know, administrative leadership in my career. I mean, I've done every position in our cancer center, except being the director and chief of medical oncology. I've done every single other thing other than that. And because I've seen what it's like first line, and it just never appealed to me. But I think looking back to my junior self, I would have said, Adam, you know, ask yourself up front, is it something that you want to do? Because it's something that you gotta kind of have to figure out earlier on in your career, I think. You know, find mentors who are division chiefs or chairs and ask yourself and talk to them and kind of visualize yourself. Is that the kind of job you want? You know, because if you don't, that's okay. But those are the kind of things I would have probably told myself up front.
And that's a fantastic overview of what sounds like quite a prolific career to date. And I'm sure there's a lot more to come. Thank you so much for being on that show. We loved everything you said, as you're sure we all like to yak a little bit on this show, and now we could keep it going for hours, but we might let you go enjoy your evening. I'm sure you've got better things to do than talk on a podcast for the rest of your evening, but thank you. And we hope to have you on again soon.
Great. No problem, guys. Thanks so much for having me. It's always fun. As you can tell, I could talk forever, and we got to end this sometimes. Okay.
Amazing.
We'll need to bring you back and cover some of the things we didn't speak about today.
Absolutely. But not a problem. Anytime.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. So, take care. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Oncology for the Inquisitive Mind. If you like this episode, there's plenty more where that came from. Check out our website, inquisitiveonc.com, that's inquisitiveonc.com, for links to all of our previous episodes. You'll find links to our social media there as well. If you'd like a particular subject covered on the show, feel free to drop us a line on Twitter at inquisitiveonc or via email at inquisitiveonc@gmail.com. This has been Oncology for the Inquisitive Mind, a podcast by ABC Productions.